Good afternoon, Scott Spears back with you here on this Thursday, last day of February 2019, 15 minutes coming up on 16 past the hour. You're tuned into the Now program. In this hour, we're going to do something very interesting. Now, let me kind of set this up for you. Christmas Day, 2006, the Godfather of Soul, James Brown, passed away. Now, at the time, it was a big story. There were a lot of things going on. Big funeral. Mr. Brown was supposed to be buried here and buried there. And there was a lot going on at that time. But the story was James Brown's passing. Now, earlier this year, in a report that I guess was started a couple years ago, a CNN reporter now believes, after talking to a woman who had some relation to Mr. Brown, who is involved in the circus, that Mr. Brown might have been murdered. And CNN put enough stock into this to do interviews, and the pieces are up on the website. So if you go to CNN, search James Brown's death. It's an interesting read. It's an interesting story. And today we're going to explore this during this hour with James Brown's last manager, somebody who knew him very well, Frank Capsaitis. Frank, how are you?
Great. How are you, Scott?
Doing well. Good to talk with you. Now, Frank, just a little background here. How long were you James Brown's manager?
I started in 2002 and went to his death, although he said we'd work together till he was 100. And that's when I said, I will have had enough. That's it.
That'll be the point when it's too much. Now, how old was Mr. Brown? Was in his 70s when he passed away?
Officially 73, but probably more like 78. Because when he was born, they didn't give out birth certificates and where he grew up. And all his friends that he went to school with and grew up with were 5 years old. And when I asked him about it, he just laughed.
How close were you being his manager?
Pretty close. We spoke regularly. I was probably at about a third of all the shows that we did. And you know, he made me sing and dance at the end of every show or get fined $25. $25 was nothing compared to the abuse for not making it on stage. But, yeah, we were very close.
Now, in 2006, James Brown was still doing shows. When did you notice? When did you notice something was wrong?
Well, mid-2006, he needed implants in his entire mouth, teeth implants. And he went to a dentist that he was loyal to in Atlanta, who evidently had lost all his privileges with anesthesiologists and hospitals. So they did it with local Novocaine. And if you've ever had an implant or know anybody who's had one, just one tooth is really hard to deal with. But a whole mouth is second to none insofar as pain. So he had Novocaine and then was in pretty constant pain after that and not feeling as well as he should.
Now, as things went into December, when did you get a flag that something really bad was going on?
Well, actually didn't get a flag of anything really bad going on until he went in the hospital a couple days before Christmas. And he was in pretty bad shape. He had gone to the dentist for more work on his teeth. And believe me, we tried to get him to switch dentists and find an anesthesiologist, but he wouldn't. He was loyal to this dentist, end of story. And then he went in the hospital. I have to say, I was a little surprised that he did. And Christmas Day or Christmas Eve Day, we were told he would be released the following day, Christmas Day, and be able to resume the tour that was scheduled actually to start the next day. But we canceled our first two shows, I believe. And he said, I'm not going to disappoint you. We're out on tour. And I even spoke to him at 10:30 Christmas Eve. And he was in great shape, great form, and ready to go on tour.
Now, this would have been 10:30 p.m. Christmas Eve?
10:30 p.m. Christmas Eve. And he died at approximately 1:15 a.m. Christmas Day. So under 3 hours before he died, he was full of energy, ready to go, and being released the next day from the hospital.
What had they diagnosed him with in the hospital?
I can't tell you that for sure right now. It is in the article that Thomas Lake at CNN did. By the way, Thomas spent 2 years doing this article, interviewed the woman who was with the circus and a friend of James Brown was the center of his article, but he interviewed over 130 people in 2 years and with the help of two other reporters as well. So they verified and checked everything and double-checked and triple-checked all the facts before they printed anything. And I have to say, he did a great job. It's a long article, but it reads like a murder mystery.
Well, that's what's so interesting about this case is because James Brown was a huge star. He was still performing when he passed away. And there was controversy at the time of his death, but it wasn't about his death. It was about his children not getting along with a wife, I believe, and he wasn't buried when he should have been. But there was nothing about murder. And then 11 years later, this report starts, which is a tremendous amount of time later, and now comes to culmination nearly 13 years after his passing, that he was possibly murdered. At the time, in 2006, when this was all actually happening in real time, when you got the call that he was dead, what did you think after speaking with him?
Well, I was shocked that he had passed, for sure. But at that point, we had to go into the mode of dealing with his death. And the following week was all about the services and the memorials and getting everything done. So there wasn't too much time to think about anything. But right after that, right after we had 2 days of sleep after being up all week, it started to hit, like, what happened? And I remember I flew down. I was in New York when I got the call, and I took the first flight down to Atlanta on Christmas morning. And when I got to Emory Hospital, I asked them if we could do a press conference later that day. And Emory said, no, we don't want to do anything. We don't do that. And I said, but you do do that. They said, well, we're not doing this in this case. I thought, well, that's kind of strange. Then it came out that the doctor, his doctor, Dr. Crawford, had said he didn't think he died of natural causes. So you start to put things together, and I said, well, they said somebody was probably in his room who should not have been there. And I said, well, can we check the security cameras at the hospital? Well, evidently, they weren't working that night. We're talking Emory Hospital. We're talking post-9/11, and no security cameras are working. So So you start to put this together and you go, something's not right. So it was pretty soon after. Not a year later, Lamar, who was married to one of James Brown's daughters, was threatening to expose his wife and others on what really happened to James Brown that night. And he was murdered in his driveway the day before he was going to reveal all this information. So we had a clue right after, pretty close to after Mr. Brown's death. There were people who felt they had factual evidence. Unfortunately, they didn't live to tell it. And I don't think there has been hard enough evidence. I wasn't aware that Andre White actually had a vial of his blood with the substance in it that was, there was a foreign substance in his vial of blood that a nurse gave to Andre White. Andre White was one of his close friends, and the nurse said, you should have this. It is properly preserved. Andre will not turn it over to anybody but authorities because of the chain of authenticity.
Have authorities asked for this?
No. Not to the best of my knowledge as of today.
When you arrived, what were you told, again, after talking to him 3 hours prior to his death, what were you told he died of?
Wasn't really told anything at that point other than he had an aneurysm, I believe is what they said. And then later on, we did not have the factual evidence at first thing in the morning. Later on in the day, we received what the doctor had said, and again, we pushed for a press conference, weren't at the hospital with the doctor, and were told it would not happen. So we landed up having a press conference at a hotel in Atlanta, but without the doctor.
Now, there are some interesting people involved at this time. Now, there is, I believe, a business manager who had had some issues with Mr. Brown and was it taxes? Is that what I'm understanding? That there had been a sort of a not a great relationship between the two and Mr. Brown had tried to let him go at one point?
Yes. David Cannon, who was his business manager, by the way, passed away this past October, was definitely a controlling force in Mr. Brown's life. And he got Mr. Brown out of his tax issues in the 80s and basically kept a thumb on him after that. We felt in the probably around 2004 that there was something very fishy going on with Mr. Cannon and started to get our suspicions and watching him carefully. We brought it up to Mr. Brown, and in 2006, Mr. Brown signed papers not to renew Mr. Cannon's agreement as his business manager. Well, subsequent to that, Mr. Cannon had Mr. Brown tear them up and sign a renewal of papers. And you say, so why would he do that? Because Mr. Cannon could intimidate Mr. Brown to do things.
Now, how could he intimidate him?
We're getting into cultural and social issues of how Mr. Brown grew up. He grew up very poor. Grew up in an area that didn't even give you a birth certificate when you were born. Mr. Cannon had a slave museum in his home and would make sure Mr. Brown knew that. And Mr. Brown was afraid of Mr. Cannon. And that's one of the reasons we wanted to get him away from him. Mr. Brown was preparing in mid-2006. He wanted to move to New York with his wife, Tommy Ray, and their son, James Brown III, to get away from the controlling forces in South Carolina, i.e. David Cannon. And as soon as Mr. Cannon found out about that, which was probably late 2006, he did not appreciate the fact that Mr. Brown would be moving or had intentions to move.
So what kind of intimidation could he use to keep him there?
Well, I know one case where he told Mr. Brown he has tax issues, and Mr. Ken said, fine, you don't want me, you deal with the IRS. And the next day, two people show up at his door and flash badges saying they're from the IRS. Now, we all know it doesn't really happen that way in real life. But then Mr. Brown freaked out and called David Cannon and said, please get these people away from me.
Now, where was David Cannon on Christmas Day 2006?
Very good question. Don't know. He claims he was in Barnwell at home.
Have you heard otherwise?
No, but that's where it gets very interesting about the cameras at the hospital. Mr. Bobbitt, who is Mr. Brown's personal manager, day-to-day person, was in the hospital room with him and left to get some antacid medication at 11:30 at night, which seems kind of strange to be going out at 11:30 at night in a hospital to get antacid. You would think they'd have it. He told me he went out to get food. So there were different stories about why he left the room. Now, at 11:30, he left, and when he came back, Mr. Brown was not in good shape. So the question, of course, remains, who had Mr. Bobbitt leave? Who came into the room during that time? Let's look at the cameras. Oh, they didn't work.
Now, Mr. Bobbitt, now he's another interesting character in all this. Now, he's the day-to-day manager, and he's at the hospital. We know that for sure. We can place him at the hospital.
Yeah.
What is his relationship with Mr. Brown personally, and what were you hearing from him during this time?
His relationship with Mr. Brown went back to the original Apollo days in 1962, 63. He worked for Mr. Brown on and off over the years. Then he became basically the right-hand man to the president of Gabon, and then Michael Jackson's personal manager for 2 years before rejoining Mr. Brown. He was Mr. Brown's best friend, no question about it. He knew more about James Brown than any living soul. I used to call Mr. Bobbitt the angel because he was the most upstanding man, and that was my relationship with him, where he was always forthcoming. So when this happened, that he left the room, I thought that was very strange. Somebody with influence had to have told him to leave, but he would never discuss it. And I did ask him a number of times.
Why do you think he wouldn't discuss it?
Because he didn't want me to know the truth, because if I knew the truth, he knew I'd do something about it.
Now, this man, who was his business manager, best friend, as you say.
No, it wasn't his business manager, his personal manager.
Day-to-day manager.
Friend.
Right.
Right.
Right. Best friend. Why would he not want something done about it?
There are a lot of unanswered questions, and that is certainly one of them.
Now, Mr. Bobbitt has since passed away. 2017, is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, Frank, this is interesting to me because James Brown passed away on December 25th, 2006. And at the time, there were a lot of tributes to James Brown and a lot of things going on. And like I say, the general story, other than that fact that he died was this whole thing with his body and not being buried right away. But I was in radio at that time, and we had done tributes to Mr. Brown. And we actually did one on January 7th, 2007. And of course, murder was certainly not the topic of that discussion. But I pulled out that tape. We were using cassette tapes back in those days. And I listened to it, and the guests on that show, you were one of the guests, and so was Mr. Bobbitt. And at one point, I had asked Mr. Bobbitt, take me through what happened at the end of James Brown's life. Now, I want to play that little three-minute excerpt of Mr. Bobbitt.
Well, I'd love to hear that.
Now, again, now remember the context of this. This is James Brown died December 25th, 2006. This interview happened January 7th, 2007. So this would have been 13 days after his death. Now, the voice you will hear is Mr. Bobbitt. Now, again, it's a little hard to hear because it was transferred over from cassette tape, but we'll do our best here. Here's the tape from 2007. Just a few days after Mr. Brown's death. The voice is Mr. Bobbitt's.
Can you kind of take us through, I don't want to become modular here, but could you kind of take us through the last few days? I mean, when did you realize things were, that he definitely was ill, and exactly what happened over the progression to Christmas Day?
Well, he had a toy giveaway that Friday in Augusta, and it was raining very hard there. I was in Atlanta waiting for him to come up to go to the dentist, and the people told me that he started coughing. He had been coughing a little bit before, but he started coughing. So he came up to the dentist, and my wife, God bless her soul, she said, baby, you need to get a doctor to check Mr. Brown before he gets in the dentist's chair, because if he gets in the chair, something might happen to him, since he wanted to be sedated. He wanted to be put to sleep. So I called a doctor, a friend of ours, and told him to be there when Mr. Brown arrived, before he got in the chair, and examine him. So I hadn't seen him for about 4 days. When he got out of the car, he really didn't look good. He was coughing. The doctor, as he came in, the dentist's office, the doctor examined him and said that it seems like you have pneumonia or bronchitis. You need to go to the hospital and be checked. And we took him to the hospital over his protest, and they found that he was ill. He was very ill, congestive heart failure, and he did have pneumonia, and he had a blood clot in his lungs. And he lasted for about a day and a half, and Christmas Day. Actually, he breathed his last at 1:20 p.m. because I looked at my watch. The doctor declared him dead at 1:45 because he worked on him for about 25 minutes. But his actual passing was very smooth. He laid back on the foot of the bed. He opened his eyes. He closed his eyes. He breathed or sighed three times very softly. If I'd have been 15 feet away, I wouldn't have heard it. I had to be leaning over him, putting a blanket on him, and he was gone.
Did he know it was the end? I mean, was he aware?
Yes. Yes, he did. I found out even more because before that, he told me, I'm going to leave here tonight. I'm going to leave here tonight. I said, no, you're not. You've got a lot of things to do. Mr. Cop Cities has a lot of dates for us and all the things that you want. And he asked about the Apollo Theater. We should get together and book the Apollo. He wanted to see the lines around them again. But I think he knew. I think he, and I'm more than sure he knew, because he said, I'm going to leave here tonight. And he did.
Frank, also, was it shocking when you heard? How did you hear of the news of his passing?
Mr. Bobbitt gave me a call and said, Mr. Brown has passed.
Were you shocked at that news?
It's funny, I went to bed that night, I couldn't go to sleep, and I thought, for some reason, this is it for Mr. Brown. And when the phone rang, I knew exactly what it was.
Definitely a hard moment, I'm sure.
Because when I spoke to him, he acted as though he knew it.
I knew it already.
Yeah.
Frank, I hope you were able to hear that. Did you hear that okay?
I did.
Now,
and I remember that all too well.
Now, interesting. Yes, yeah, just
at 10:30, he was perfectly fine. That's what freaked me out when I went to bed. Because at 10:30, he had said, I'm going to be there. We're doing the shows this week. He was full of energy. And yet, when I put my head on the pillow, something hit me saying, he's going to die tonight. And I thought, what did I just say? That's horrible. No, that's not going to happen. And I tossed and turned a bit. And then I got the call. When the phone rang, I knew exactly what it was. You just knew. But I still was shocked. And certainly Mr. Bobbitt, when he says he knew he was on the way out, he didn't know he was on his way out that day. As a matter of fact, he had, on that 10:30 call, I first spoke to Mr. Bobbitt, who said, yep, he's being released tomorrow. He's in good shape.
Now, Frank, that certainly clears up your end, and I think we all can understand that when we have a friend who's in the hospital. I think that's, and somebody calls you and says something like that. But there are things that Mr. Bobbitt said there that I think are interesting, that are a little, like I said, at that time, who knew this would ever come up 13 years ago? But
right.
Mr. Bobbitt says that when Mr. Brown came from the toy drive to the dentist, that he was sick, that people had said he was sick, that he didn't look well, and that the hospital had diagnosed him as soon as he went in with a blood clot and pneumonia and congestive heart failure, I believe he said.
Right.
Is any of that true?
I don't know, because I wasn't at the hospital to tell you and say firsthand it's true, it's not true. I know they started treating him right away for whatever it is he had. And I probably was told back then, I don't remember anymore. But I know he was treated for whatever it was and responded very well to it, well enough that on Christmas Eve day, he was being released the next day. And he felt good enough to be released and to continue the show.
Now, interestingly enough, as you had said earlier, there was a person in the room when James Brown died, and that he was going to release what had really happened in that room, and he was killed. Mr. Bobbitt explains the last moments there. He says he was in the room when Mr. Brown died.
Right. Daryl Lamar was not in the room.
He was not in the room.
He was the person who was going to expose everybody. He was not, as far as I know, again, we don't know who was in that room, but as far as I know, he wasn't there. He was going to expose what actually happened. Now, Mr. Washington, who is Mr. Brown's groundskeeper, caretaker at his home, was in the adjoining room. There were two rooms together, and he was asleep when Mr. Brown passed. So Mr. Bobbitt was in Mr. Brown's room when he passed. Mr. Washington was next door. And Andre Johnson had been at the hospital the whole time with Mr. Brown, wouldn't go home. And finally they said to him, you need to go home. He's fine. He's being released tomorrow. And he left, and that was the night everything turned south.
Well, and this is another interesting point that you brought up, and also with the three-minute excerpt there from that interview. You said Mr. Bobbitt had went out to get an antacid, get something at some point, which is kind of strange, at some point during that night, never really saying...
Even getting a bite to eat at midnight or 11:30 p.m.
Right.
Was open.
Right. And in that tape, in his own words, the late Mr. Bobbitt is in the room when Mr. Brown passes, said Mr. Brown knew he was dying. He could hear these sighs, that Mr. Brown was on the end of the bed, that they were having this conversation about, come on, you've got to go to the Apollo, and so on and so forth. Had you heard that from Mr. Bobbitt afterward?
Yes. And what basically happened, according to Mr. Bobbitt, was there was a huge turn in his condition from before he left the room to the time he returned. When he returned, he was in really bad shape. And he was cold and put blankets over me and my feet. And Mr. Bobbitt, I think I'm leaving, and very much towards the end, or he knew he was at the end. But it happened very suddenly. So So what if we take Mr. Bobbitt's timeline of he left the room at somewhere between 11:30 to get a bite to eat and came back at 12:30 or 1, and he was gone evidently for about an hour, maybe a little more, and that comes from what Mr. Bobbitt had told me. And what happened during that hour is the question.
I think you're right. And all the stuff that happened prior that Mr. Bobbitt describes there about being at the toy drive, starting to cough, going to the dentist, having a doctor come to the dentist office, and the doctor said, we think you might have pneumonia, you need to go on to the hospital, diagnosis of pneumonia, blood clot, congestive heart failure, which is all happening in the course of about 48 hours here. But you were never told that he was that ill when he went in.
I was told he was that ill when he went in.
But it turned around.
But then it turned around quickly.
So,
I think there are two other big picture items that need to be known about Mr. Brown at that time. So he was doing about 100 shows a year, which is a lot of shows. And after he'd come back from the shows and get to Augusta, he would tell everybody, including me, this is it. I'm an old man. I can't tour like this. It's too many shows. Too much for me. Not a week later, he'd be on the phone saying, when are we going out again? He lived for touring. That was his world. And when he'd go back out on tour, maybe 2-3 weeks later, he was so excited to be out on tour. He'd be well. He really, if anything, he wasn't happy when he was home in Augusta. He was very happy on the road. The second thing is he said to me more than once, I haven't had this much fun since I first started in the business. So he was actually having a good time again with the band, with everything going on. He was recording three new songs. The week after he died up in Montreal, we had a studio set up. And he was really excited about that. And I don't know if you heard this story about one of the songs he was going to record. And please stop me if you've heard it. But John Legend wrote a song for he and Aretha Franklin to do as a duet. And it just spelled Grammy all over it. Incredible song. And we have been trying to get Mr. Brown to do his part of that song, track it, and sing the lyrics for about a year. And he said, I can't sing it. And we're like, why not? He said, it's disrespectful to my wife. We're like, what do you mean? He said, well, the lyrics in there, I am your woman, you are my man, and, you know, you are my woman, you are my man, whatever. And we're like, you sing worse than that every night. He said, nope, not going to do it. So Mr. Bobbitt ran into Aretha Franklin in New York and said, are you going to do that song with Mr. Brown? And she said, I ain't singing with that son of a bee. And we said, ah, something's up. And we asked Mr. Brown, and it turns out they had a torrid love affair that had never been resolved. Not many people know about James Brown and Aretha. But it went on for quite a while, evidently. So that's why neither of them wanted to do it. But Aretha had agreed and Mr. Brown had agreed, and that's why we had the studio booked the following week in Montreal so he could do that song.
Mm. It's interesting. Something else that strikes me is when we started the interview is this dentist who doesn't sound like a very good dentist. And he had been to him 6 months earlier, I think, as you had said, prior to his death. And that's when some things started not to look so good health-wise. And in Mr. Bobbitt's detailing the last day or so there, he was on his way to this dentist again. And the doctor cut him off. So what does this dentist play in this whole issue?
That's a good question. I don't know if he plays a huge role other than, you know, when you're 73 or 78 years old and you're going through tooth implants and doing it on Novocaine, there's so much pain involved that can your body deal with that amount of pain? So I think it really took its toll on him. Although that summer, the summer of 2006, Mr. Brown knocked it up on tour. Mm. We were out in October, and it was a great tour. His last show was last full show with the band was actually in Zagreb. And then he flew home and came back over about a week and a half later to do the UK Music Awards in London, where he was honored. And that was his last public appearance, which was the beginning of November 2006. And then we were going back out right after Christmas for five shows in the U.S. and then the Canadian tour.
Now, Frank, in the last about 10 minutes we have left here, I want to speed up to the story here, 2017. This woman from the circus gets in touch with the reporter from CNN. Now, what is her relationship, for people who haven't read the story, and I implore them to, on CNN? What is her relationship to Mr. Brown, and did you know about it?
I knew about it. Her relationship was very close to Mr. Brown, and they started the I Feel Good Trust together, which was to, upon Mr. Brown's death, was to be funded by 50% of his estate to help children in music education and education. A lot of people, well, Mr. Brown never wanted people to know this, but he would pass out $100 bills like water when we were on tour to kids. And he'd say, are you going to promise me you're going to stay in school and study? He said, if you promise me this, you can have $100. And he would do this regularly. So it meant a lot to him. Jackie was his partner in this foundation and kind of got pushed off to the side by David Cannon and other people. And by the time I was involved, she was really nowhere in sight. But she had started a lawsuit while I was there, and Deborah Opry was the attorney who was handling it for Mr. Brown, and I was in regular contact with Deborah about the case, but then the case kind of slid away. So everybody at that point was saying, oh, this woman, she's a bit crazy. On the other hand, there were a lot of people who said she's not as crazy as everybody says she is. She was trying to do the right thing with Mr. Brown, but nobody else around wanted to help in that regard. The 1990s was not a good time for Mr. Brown. He was under the influence of a lot of alternative substances and wasn't thinking straight. From the time pretty much he got out of prison till 2002 when he went, or 2001 when he went through rehab. And so during that period, things were a little funky to say the least. But then in 2002, he really had his act together. He was off all the drugs and ready to hit it again for another round. And he said he wanted to keep going till he was 100.
You know, Frank, you knew this man, James Brown, and it is interesting because when you look back at his life, a lot of good things, a lot of memorable things, certainly without question, a huge place in the history of the music business. But there are these things, like trouble with the IRS, a prison term, drug issues, when he died, as I said, I've alluded to, the whole issue about him not being buried, his family and his wife having issues. Now this surrounding his death, was it a murder? What about him led to these peculiar situations? This dentist, this guy who was his business manager, who were these people? How did he get in this position?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I have to say, I've worked with a lot of major artists, And artists at any level are really good at shooting themselves in the foot. They're very secure on stage. They own that stage. They own the world when they're on stage. When they get off stage, they become very insecure and sometimes self-destructive. And in the case of Mr. Brown with the dentist, I had some real heart-to-heart conversations, and some of them I was pretty pointed with him about, if you say you love all of us as much as you do, why are you doing this? You're hurting us, not only you, but us as well, the people you say you love. So why are you doing this? And we get him to come out a little bit and agree maybe to see somebody else, but by the time we had it set up, he'd cancel it.
Now his,
and we get into it again.
Now, his last wife, quite a bit younger.
Yep,
what,
Tommy Ray.
Yeah, what was her relationship with him, and why did there become this big issue after he passed about him being laid to rest?
Okay, those are two very separate questions. Tommy Ray, he loved her heart and soul, period. Now, as I described, there are some people who consider the perfect marriage going home every night for 20 years. You have dinner, you watch TV and hold hands, and that's the perfect quiet life. And then there are other people who go home and fight, and they love the fighting. They thrive on it. And Mr. and Mrs. Brown were two people who just loved sparring with each other. It was what their lives were about. It's what gave them joy. A lot of people can't quite understand that or grasp that, but that's really what made them happy and also made them very passionate. So there was a true love for her, and all said and done, he was in love with her. Even when he took out full-page ads and Variety to say, we're not together anymore, that was a ploy to get her mad at him. And they play these games with each other, but at the end of the day, they loved each other dearly. So, and he asked me a number of times, make sure she's okay after I'm gone. He was always concerned about her. To answer your other question about the body, that is the question CNN brings up as well. Where is the body now? Supposedly, it's in a crypt above ground at one of his daughter's houses. But nobody can get to it because if you go there, you're trespassing. And there's a question if the body is still there. To the best of my knowledge and the best of Thomas Lake at CNN, who talked to all these people, Mr. Brown has still not been buried.
What was the reason for that? What was the problem?
Well, they wanted to do an autopsy on him after his death, and his daughter said absolutely not. And they were very protective of the body.
So,
that's about all I can say about that.
Well, Frank, it's a fascinating story, and I think that's why CNN has found it fascinating. Now, you being there at the end of his life, when this is all going on and meeting a lot of these interesting characters, the dentist, the manager, Mr. Bobbitt, who were all around his family. Now that you look back on it, hindsight, over 12 years later, do you believe he was murdered? And if so, who did it? I mean, what was the reason?
Do I think he died of natural causes? No. I am in concurrence with his doctor. His doctor was saying it for medical reasons. I'm saying it for reasons that a lot of things just don't add up and make sense. So I would say, yes, something went afoul. Who did it? I know CNN's on that for the next chapter of all of this, and I'm as anxious to read it as you are. There's more to come, for sure.
Well, and I think CNN, you're right, will. But do you have a belief of who it was? Obviously, you don't know who CNN thinks. We don't know who CNN thinks. But you knew these people who surrounded him. Is there a likely person there?
I have been racking my brain on that question. I think there are some people who were probably involved. The question is how involved. You know, you asked, where was David Cannon the night Mr. Brown died? Well, he was in Barnwell, South Carolina. Was he really? Maybe he was, but that doesn't mean that he might not have had something to do with it.
Let me ask you this, Frank, because I think maybe this is the most poignant part in our last 2 minutes here. Because we heard Mr. Bobbitt's voice. Mr. Bobbitt's no longer with us. Dear friend of James Brown, day-to-day manager, who was at the hospital, in the room, left for whatever reason, and his kids, his daughter may have his body, may not have his body, his wife. I assume she was somewhere in this whole situation. Do these people who are at the scene, one has his body now, one described his final moments, do they have guilt in this, in your opinion? Do they have suspicion?
That's a good question. I think Mrs. Brown believes, Tommy Ray, that something went afoul with her husband. She was in rehab in California and was told her husband would be fine at the hospital, that everything was under control. And she was flying home Christmas Day, but she didn't take the next flight home because they said he's fine, he's being released Christmas Day. So she was flying back from California to be with him when he was released from the hospital. But she thinks something went afoul as well. And so far as guilt of other people, no, I can't say I saw guilt of anyone. Mr. Bobbitt was certainly changed a number of his stories about what happened that night over time. I have Mr. Bobbitt's stories on tape. We started doing a book with him. And it's just interesting the way it all comes together. There's a lot. Everybody had their suspicions, including Mr. Bobbitt. But nobody came forth with anything concrete. And the one person who was going to come forward with something concrete got shot down in his driveway.
Frank, with 30 seconds left to go, and I certainly appreciate this, and I'm just asking this, not necessarily from the guilt perspective, but is there any chance with the relationship that Mr. Brown's daughter had with him or the relationship that Mr. Bobbitt had with him, being in the room when he died and at the hospital when he got sick, is there, not that they contributed to it, but is there any chance they didn't know what happened, that it could have just all been done under their nose and they would have no idea?
I have no idea about that. All I do know is Mr. Brown did not want his daughters to receive a dime once he died, because they had sued him years earlier, that they had co-written his hits when they were 4 and 7 years old, and they brought him to court, and it cost him a lot of money to defend that. And he said they need to learn about the legal system, then not to get a dime.
Why do you think Mr. Bobbitt changed his stories?
Mr. Bobbitt was all the same age as Mr. Brown, basically, maybe a year older. Occasionally he'd get confused. Occasionally he just would not tell a story.
It's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting, and we'll see what that third part of that CNN series, the conclusion they come to, and we'll see what happens from it. Maybe the authorities will get involved and we'll find out where Mr. Brown is. We'll find out if there was foul play. The vial of blood is around, so hopefully maybe one day, Frank, you can come back with us and we can continue on with this and hopefully find out exactly what happened on Christmas Day 2006 to the Godfather of Soul, James Brown. Frank Capsaitis has been the guest. He was Mr. Brown's last manager. Thank you, Frank.
You're welcome. Thank you, Scott.
Take care. Bye-bye. I'll tell you, interesting story. Remember tomorrow, 11 to 3, Tony Pacos. More programming on the way. This is Scott Spears, headed to the dugout.
House, where she gave notably elegant parties. She was the first lady to vote, operate a movie camera, own a radio, hold her own press conferences, movie stars to the White House. Magnificent Marion.